Taxation number 11938, Reel 37.
Mr. G. Iston, Reel 37. Could you see, Mr. Iston, as time went on, that things were changing? Material was becoming, was coming in much greater numbers and amounts?
Yes. Well, I just mentioned about Geneva, and we were down there, and we saw the trucks and vehicles coming in, and the tanks. I mean, the Sherman was, to us, a real tank. It looked as though it was going to compare with anything that the Germans had, because it was a... The Grant was a good tank, but it was more of an howitzer than the Sherman was. Also at Geneva, I had to visit the British workshops down there, and this was quite a surprise, because they were in fact still using whips to keep the wogs working, the Arabs working. Maybe that's not strictly true, because the majority were being paid to be there, they were being fed, and most of them were enjoying the fact that they were working at Geneva. But the Arabs still have this thing about anything that doesn't move, it can be pilfered. And the whip was really to let them know that anything laid around was British and not Arab. But they still had the sergeants running the workshop. They had the whip. There was no doubt about that. It sort of reminded me of the slaves in the ships in the galleys. But it wasn't that sort of a situation at all, really. It was certainly they were trying to use them, but it was more of a crack. It was letting them know they'd been spotted, let me say. They were idling the time, or they were being tempted to pick things up. And, of course, back at the... I've just mentioned that there were about 10 aerodromes around us. We could see now that the Spitfire had arrived. We hadn't seen much of the Spitfire on the desert at all. We'd seen it in England before we left, because we'd seen the Battle of Britain on the south coast. But we hadn't seen much of it there. And we also saw these Hurricanes with the great long gun sticking out in front of it, more or less coming out from underneath it, but sticking out in front of it. And I understood it was a Bofa gun, a 40mm Bofa gun mounted on the Hurricane. Certainly it was a long gun, but whether it was actually the Bofa or not, I can't swear.
What was its task?
It was nicknamed the Tin Opener. And certainly once he got his line on the tanks, I think the Bofa did about 40 rounds a minute. So if the pilot got the tank in his sights, he could let go to something and the tank had to give, more or less, because he would be going flying towards it with his gun blazing away. And as he got closer, of course, the shells were getting heavier, because you've got the speed of the aircraft to start with, and then you've got the extra pump of the gun. We were told that the aircraft almost stopped every time the gun fired. I don't think that was strictly true. And another great thing that we saw now was what did they call them? The Swordfish. I think it was a Mustang, really, an American plane with a big air cooler underneath it. And the squadron, well, I don't know what the squadron do. It was general practice with this aeroplane. They painted it like a shark's head, using the air cooler as the mouth, and then putting the teeth until he finally got back at the head. And they were called Swordfish to us. I think it was actually an American Mustang. So, yes, we could see things going. And the amount of planes that were taking off made it quite uncomfortable for us, because on the desert, every time a plane goes or comes, it creates a hell of a dust. Oh, a hell of a dust. How those mechanics kept them flying, I just can't imagine. When you think of the problems we had with the Brens and the Vickers and things like that, to try and keep them clean. I mean, just the fact that you've got a Vickers gun on a tripod and find a way, the vibration of the tripod was sending dust up into the working parts. So how these aircraft mechanics kept those things flying, it's hard to imagine. But fly, they certainly did. And so, yes, we're getting a great feeling that things were... I mean, we'd hardly seen our planes on the desert, or in France, if it comes to that. We knew later that they'd been to France because of quite a few arguments between the Air Force and the SWAT as to what the hell were they doing during Dunkirk. But we knew that they had been out, and we knew that they'd done a good job, really. And, of course, the same thing happened on the desert. You hardly ever saw them. But you still knew that there was something happening, because every now and again you could hear bombs dropping in the enemy lines, where somebody had gone over and they found something that was worth bombing. See, on the desert, the problem wasn't the bombing, but find something close enough together to bomb. Because to bomb vehicles which are 200 yards apart, it's not on. You strap them, yes. You could come down and strap them with your guns. But to drop bombs, I mean, it was just a waste of time, unless you could find something that was concentrated.
You mentioned that the role of the battalion, Mr. Eyston, was one of airfield defence. What exactly did that entail?
Well, as vehicles and men became available, the job was, we expected paratroops coming down. And I think that was a sensible attitude for anybody to take. If Rommel got held up at El Alamein, we keep saying El Alamein, it wasn't known as that then, it was just the line. El Alamein became along later when some newsmen saw the station with El Alamein on, and they took a picture of the station, and from then on it became the El Alamein line. It was the line at that stage, but we call it El Alamein to keep the thing in perspective. If Rommel was held up at El Alamein, the most probable attack was going to come, that he was going to attack the airfields and into the Delta, and that most likely would be paratroops. I don't think we did say, but after Crete, we now know that he never used paratroops anymore. I think he had such a shock at Crete with the 1st Battalion disposing a lot of his paratroopers for all the 1st Battalion were chased off Crete. They certainly took a large account of his paratroopers, and I don't think the Germans ever used paratroops as an attacking force again. But we had seen paratroops, or I hadn't seen them, but we knew the paratroops had landed in Crete, and we knew what paratroops could do when they landed in force. And so obviously, any commander is going to defend his airfields, and he's going to defend the wealth of the Delta, because that was Egypt's wealth. It was all in the Delta. Egypt was a vast country, but it was just a V from Alexandria to Port Said, and the V went just down past Cairo, and that was the wealth of Egypt, really. That's where the cotton was, and where all the cultivation was, all in that one strip. So obviously, if he could get the British airfields and the Delta, he'd had a marvellous prize, because the Suez Canal was almost on it. So that's what he was after, was the Suez Canal, basically, and then he'd stopped our supplies getting in.
So what were you doing in the airfield situation?
The airfields, we were as fast as vehicles and men could be trained and brought together. We were developing mobile exercises to attack any paratroops which might drop. Now, the nights weren't very nice. We were doing exercises most nights. But while we were doing our exercises, the Germans were dropping flares, and they were lighting the complete area up. There were a few bombs as well, but The main thing was these flares. They were looking to see where the airfields were so they could come down and strafe the planes on the ground if possible. And virtually was very little sleep at night. And if we didn't get our siesta through the day, I mean, there was no sleep at all. We'd just got nicely back and settled in. And doing a bit of training, we'd done our digging, part of it anyway, and we're settled in and digging. And then the army always comes along with this. Once a unit, a battalion, a company, a brigade or a division has had a mauling, the army's answer is a GOC's inspection. Well, with the losses of the brigade from Gazala, they were quite severe. I think we'd lost something like 8,000 men in the brigade during that period. They weren't all killed, but I mean, we'd lost them. They were no longer part of the brigade. And Ramsden had gone off, I think, to Corps, and our brigade commander Nichols had taken over the division, and the commander of 9th Battalion had taken over the brigade. Now, he and I never got on very well, not even when he was brigade major, before he took command of the 9th Battalion.
Who was this?
Colonel Percy. He was a sod as a brigade commander. And I suppose I met him first when I was working with Peter Jeffries. When he was brigade major, not brigade commander, when he was brigade major, he was a sod. And then, of course, he took over the 9th Battalion, and I lost track of him again, but he was... Moves around. I mean, we used to see him occasionally. And then, of course, he came back as brigadier at Amaria. So he would have an inspection one day and Nichols would have his inspection the next day. Now, I had a problem because when I passed my driver mechanics test in the Cotswold, I was supposed to wear a driving wheel with a laurel round it on the forearm of the right arm, I think it was the right arm. But I got off that. I said he looked too much like a sergeant major. He's now getting confused with a sergeant major. So I finally got off that. But when I, in Gazala, I'd spent a week with LAD, the brigade LAD, and taken my fitness test. So that was hammer and tongs crossed. And I did ask about it while I was at when I passed my course, and they said, oh, you can make that out of a sheet of brass. I didn't have much time at Gazala for making hammer and tongs out of brass. However, one of the sergeants had given me one, which I pinned up proudly, because I was really proud of this this fitter business, because it meant that I was almost the same rate as a sergeant, same pay as a sergeant, and that pleased me no end. So I had worn it, but it was getting quite dilapidated by the time we got back to Amaria, and there was quite a few problems about I wasn't wearing it then, because all our clothes had more or less gone. And there was another thing they came across with. I should be wearing two wound stripes. Why two? I can't imagine. I was wounded at Arras. But where they got the other one from, I don't know. Now, the wound stripe was a diagonal red stripe, about 1 1/4 inches long on a black base. And depending on the number of times you've been wounded, you had different stripes on your left arm, again on the forearm. Well, the quartermaster and the tailor, between them, I didn't want these brass ones because they were to polish and they didn't go very well on the shirt sleeve. So I wanted the cloth ones embroidered, well, yes, embroidered. Hamlin tongs. And so I said I didn't have any Hamlin tongs. And there was war on about that. Eventually, the quartermaster and Sergeant Hines, the tailor, they came up and they'd found some cloth ones when they stitched them on. Mine was all new uniform by now. I mean, the old uniform.
You've been issued a few stuff.
We'd got new stuff, and we'd lost, I don't know why I didn't mention them or not, but the original shorts were turnips. They were handy in a swamp area where you got mosquitoes getting around your knees at night, but you could drop them down in your sort of half long trousers. But we got shot of them by now in Egypt, because the mosquito thing had gone. And we were in nice shorts, and where they also a KD, like a light tunic, a summer tunic, and long trousers, which were like a dress uniform. But for the inspection, it was going to be shirt sleeves. So I said, well, there's nowhere to put the warm stripes. And eventually, I think the battalion agreed that that was going to be a silly sort of an affair. But I did get my hammer and tongs on. Now, the thing that always got me about the duos, any inspection, you would start with your platoon sergeant. He would do an inspection. Your platoon commander would do an inspection. Your company commander would do an inspection. The RSM would do an inspection. The adjutant would do an inspection. The colonel would do an inspection. And then the brigadier would come along and he'd find fault. This was invariable that this would happen. So we did, 21st of July, we did Brigadier Percy's, and the following day we did General Nichols. Fortunately, it was late in the afternoon when Nichols got to us, because he'd been all over the division previously. But this is a thing that happened. It happened to us again after Marathon, it happened to us again after Wadi Zigzag, that we had these GOC's inspections. But it seems to be the principle. If an army has a mauling, well, then we'll have a GOC's inspection.
Did this entail a great deal of spit and polish?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. We're back to civilian... to peacetime things to a certain extent. For all we're doing our exercises at night and we've got guards on. That was another thing that got me. They started doing a mounted guard, where the same thing happens. You're inspected by a platoon sergeant and it goes all through the lot until finally the adjutant mounts the guard at so-and-so. And then, of course, if they're looking for the stick guard, it can get really serious that you're even checking your boots to see if you've got the right studs in, or one thing or another. That again got me, because that we're still in a wartime situation, but we're trying to do a peacetime things. Didn't like that. Anyway, we got over it, and the inspection went very well, as far as I know. One or two little things were picked up. He was very, very keen, Percy. He was a good soldier. There's no doubt about it. I think all the Percys were, weren't they? They noted throughout history, the Percys. I don't know whether they're all the same family or not, but they are noted throughout history for their work. Well, then, I think it was the 27th, so that's like 5 days after the GOC's inspection. There's a few perks at this camp. I mean, the sea wasn't too far away, so you could get a truckload of people together and you could go and have a swim, so and that cooled things down a bit. It made you feel fresher. For all seawater, it doesn't really make you feel fresh. It is nice to get a swim down again. And there was day trips into Alex, which I didn't catch many of, because now I'm a fitter, I'd sort of lost my driving side of the business. While I was a driver mechanic, it was only long trips, it was a good idea to send a driver mechanic. But now I was more or less grounded now, apart from these trips to go and collect vehicles from Knifa. And another place we went to, and I can't think of the name of it, it was somewhere halfway between the station at El Alamein and El Alamein. And it was a marvellous place. There was a railway going into it and a road beside it, sort of a siding going into this place. But you went through a gap in two mountains. And then inside, it was just like a secret valley. There's mountains all the way around it, and a hollow inside it. And it was absolutely packed with vehicles. We had to go up there to draw vehicles and weapons on one time. And coming back out again, I can always remember it, as we got back to the main road, the coast road, there's a low Egyptian, a long Egyptian type of vehicle, where they have hut. You know, the type you see them in the Far East sometimes, where the roof is very steep, and then at the corners it sort of turns up, and you've got a post on the end of it. That's still pretty, this, a reddish building. And that was like a bar. I suppose it was really sort of a roadhouse of some sort. But there's a bar there, and just at that particular spot, the road is sort of green on one side and desert on the other. It was really a lovely spot. But I can't remember the name of it. It's just sort of halfway between the two stations. So we were getting equipped quite well now.
Was there anything new in that equipment situation?
Yes. We'd started to pick the 6-pounder up, because the RA now had got the 17-pounder. I've said a few times of how badly equipped we were as far as the anti-tank went, right from the start of the war with the Riley .5 gun. But now the RA, or the anti-tank side of the RA, were being equipped with a 17-pounder, and we were getting a 6-pounder anti-tank. So it was still on a port E, but a much heavier gun, and I mean, it was our only anti-tank gun until we got back to Alamein. So now, yes, we're getting the 6-pounder. I think we're getting more wireless orientated, but there was still a scarcity really of wireless, and they were very they were poor. You had to be in the right direction and the right place and the right height and one thing or another, otherwise you're blacked out. Today they've got things where they put a booster station in and more or less drive the waves round a bend. But, in those days, you had to be in just the right line before you could get in touch. But we were getting more through, but not sufficient by any means. In fact, on the 27th, we were told we were taking a company back in the line again. And I think it was D Company again, I'm nearly sure. It was Cummings D Company.
Crook.
I think I'm nearly sure it was Major, where it was Captain Cummings then. And D Company. We were told we were going back in the line again. And naturally we thought we were going back to do a similar job to the one we'd done when we came back from Mersey. Except this was going to be a bit bigger, that Colonel Battlescombe was going to take a composite battalion. He was going to take his own headquarters and a company, I think that was D Company, S Company, and the 8th Battalion were going to supply a company, and the 9th Battalion supply a company. And we naturally just thought we were going back to into the defence of the line again. We weren't very happy about it, because we had been told we'd be doing this airport patrol for quite a while, but until we got properly established again. Anyway, on the 27th we went back, and we stopped just quite close to Alamein main station. And Colonel Battlescombe went off and had his conference with the, I think it was the 69th Brigade, Cook Hollis, of the 69th Brigade. And he came back and told us we were going to do an attack with the 69th Brigade and the Australians and somebody else. Now, I didn't know a lot about this, because it wasn't really my field. The attacking side wasn't really my field. Mine was to get a service, really, to make sure they get there. And I don't remember a great deal about it. We used to hear things over the grapevine. And we saw the battalion go through the minefield. And I was with S Company, and sort of battalion. By this time, we got more or less like three echelons for the battalion. We had the, like a command post with a colonel up front. We had Dickie Ovenden, Major Ovenden, with a battalion rear HQ. And then, of course, there was another rear HQ at Amaria. So we were like in three echelons then. So I was with S Company and battalion rear HQ. Oh, I would say battalion, you could say Battiscombe was advanced HQ and we were HQ and then there was a rear HQ, so we'll say we were with HQ. And we were at the line a long time at the minefield waiting to be called forward. Now, I do remember having to pull one vehicle off the minefield, but I suppose by this time that it was so much of a natural occurrence that I don't remember a great deal about them. I think by this time I'm getting so used to war that a lot of the things that earlier on stuck in my memory, now they're a natural thing. And I don't remember this. I think it was a signal struck. Wasn't one of ours, but I think it was a signal struck, and I took two carriers up to pull it off anyway, with three tow ropes joined together. And we went through onto the minefield and sort of hitched it up and pulled it off with two carriers, one on each side. Nobody in it. We just pulled it off and got it off, fortunately.
Were you waiting for the others to come back to take them back? That was
No. We were waiting to go forward because we had the anti-tank guns and the mortars. And once we surmised that the battalion had reached its point, which was 5,000 yards ahead, a long stretch from the attack. But this was like a brigade attack, really. In fact, it was more than a brigade attack, because there was Australian brigade on the right, I think it was, and the 69th brigade on the left, and we were at this battalion.
Could you see the enemy reaction to it?
You can hear more than you can see. You can see tracers flying around, and you can hear the big guns. You can see blasts from the big guns.
This went in at night, did it?
You can hear more, yes. We just after dusk, I think. Just after dusk. About midday, I think it was, when we're at just outside Alman Station, because that's when I saw it, really, for the first time. And then we turned down to the desert a little bit. And I think it was somewhere near Reeswat Ridge or something like that. But that's where the attack went in. And you can hear it. And you know your mates are out there and you don't know what's happening. But we had a good idea by the sound of the battle that they were on their point. Now, why we never followed through, I just don't know. It's I believe, from hearing things later, that the two wireless sets involved broke down, or there was no communication through the wireless sets. Two runners got cut off and couldn't get back. And I believe that, in fact, the enemy more or less let the troops go through and then came in behind them and cut them off that way. But I don't know, I wasn't there. I didn't get through the mine.
So what happened to you then?
We packed up and went back. There was one or two stragglers came through, I believe, but and they said they'd had a terrible time, but we just packed up and went back to the battalion.
So Colonel Battiscombe and Cummins would be lost, were they?
Of course, later on we found out that, yes, in fact, not anybody had come back. Just one or two stragglers had got back. Captain Kirby, I think, was in command of S Company then. And I believe he had tried to get one of his anti-tank guns through. But I don't think it landed. Again, I'd done what I had to do, and quite honestly, I was glad I was on the way back again, because This was one time when we did think we'd been deceived by our higher officers, but yet we weren't deceived, because it was just that we thought we were going to into a defensive position, while in fact we were going to do an attack, which was, well, it's not deception really, is it? A soldier's trained to do what he's told to do, not to think.
So you lose a whole company.
We lost a full company. I think the 8th Battalion got some of their company back, and again the 9th Battalion took quite a hammering, I think. We were partly let down, I believe, by South Africans who were supposed to clear the minefields, which they hadn't. In fact, the troops had to run through the minefield before they started their attack. Before they got to the start line, they'd had to skip through the minefield, as you might say, through the mines, because the minefield hadn't been cleared sufficiently. And this signal truck, I think it was a signal truck, that had hit a mine, and of course it had to be pulled out of there.